This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of February 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. The Austin City Council hires a new consultant to help with homelessness.
Matthew Doherty was the head of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness.
To address the city's wildfire risk, Austin firefighters look to California.
I look at the continuous fuel that goes right up to the houses, and I'm like, ugh.
And the unique role of sports medicine at Texas rodeos.
The bigger things to me are the people who come in with fractures that were at a rodeo that didn't have medical coverage, and they're like, what's wrong with my arm? Well, it's broken.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
My point is, how is he an expert in homelessness when you have experts right here? You have experts all over the street.
That's Christy Thompson, a woman who told the Austin City Council this week she's been homeless since September after she and her wife were overwhelmed by medical debt following a near-fatal car wreck.
Do you take the time to ask them with compassion how they find their food and their medical care or housing? How they came to be on the street?
She was talking to the city council about their plan to approve a $95,000 8-month contract to hire a former federal bureaucrat, Matthew Doherty, to consult on homelessness. But the vote was not without its share of contention. KUT's Andrew Weber covers homelessness issues for us. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Nathan.
Council did approve the contract.
They did, yes, sir.
But not unanimously.
Not unanimously. Councilmember Jimmy Flanagan voted against the contract because he said that he didn't feel that he was properly educated on it. And he brought up the sort of challenges that the city faced with its homelessness czar, Loria Pampilo-Harris, who was hired after about a year-long search. Overall, it took about 2 years for that position to sort of come into fruition, but she left after a month, and the city was putting a lot of stock in her guiding the city's policies on an executive level. It didn't pan out, and she has since left the city as of January 3rd. He brought up that the city faced a lot of challenges in that process and suggested that they didn't necessarily need more outside help and that the city should defer to Ending Community Homelessness Coalition, which is the quarterback for homeless services and federal money, and that the city doesn't necessarily need to get into the nitty-gritty and they should let ECHO handle that in partnership with the city.
Who is the consultant they hired, Matthew Doherty?
Matthew Doherty was the head of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. That whole umbrella organization shepherds federal programs and guides the overall federal response to homelessness, whereas the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development handles the money aspect of it as far as housing and services.
So what is he actually going to do?
The city wants him to sort of leverage that experience to get more federal money, find creative short and long-term solutions for homelessness.
Christy Thompson raised an interesting point. How much does the city of Austin consult with people who are living on the streets when they're trying to adopt policies to address homelessness?
The city recently established the Homelessness Advisory Council, and that is a group of folks who are service providers and involved in, you know, sort of criminal justice aspect of it, public health aspect of it, and folks who are experiencing or have experienced homelessness.
Separately this week, city council members got an estimate on how much it would cost to establish an emergency shelter in a city-owned property that's on Red River and 12th Street. I think it's 1215 Red River. What's it called? The Health South building?
Yeah, the Health South building. It used to house a rehab center, and there's a parking garage attached. For the last couple of months, council members have floated the idea of using it as a temporary emergency shelter for about a year or two. There was a memo earlier this week that suggested retrofitting it could cost anywhere from $2.5 to nearly a little over $6.5 million, and that it would take about 2 years, 24 to 30 months, which, as the city's dealing with homelessness, may not be the quickest response, which is something that Natasha Harper Madison brought up when I spoke to her earlier this week.
Yeah, I certainly don't want us to make such a large financial and or time investment for an asset that we use temporarily. My hope is that we are as frugal as possible as a municipality and use our resources wisely.
Why is there such a wide discrepancy in how much it would cost to retrofit the Health South facility as a shelter, like $2.5 million to more than $6.5 million? That seems like a pretty broad estimate.
Right. So there wasn't an overall code inspection of nuts and bolts. Here is what it would cost itemized. It's a high end and a low end. So that's why you have that discrepancy.
But they might use the garage for something?
Yes. So this is a big issue for a lot of homeless folks that I've talked to. Storing your stuff. If you're trying to transition out of homelessness and you go to a job interview and you have all of your earthly belongings, there is a bias. Some folks may not hire you. Carrying everything that you own around all the time is a pain. So the city says it's going to, by the end of March, have 300 storage bins for folks who are experiencing homelessness at the parking garage at Health South.
What about the $8 million plan to renovate the roadway inn on the I-35 service road between Old Torf and Royal Hill in South Austin?
This is a bridge housing approach to house people and then get them services. Mayor Adler said this week that he is committed to that model.
I want us to move forward on the motel strategy. I want us to start finding more places for people to go that are on our streets so that we can get them off our streets.
From Echo's standpoint, Matt Malika, who headed up Echo, has used the strategy before in Denver and San Francisco. He touts it as a pretty successful and cost-effective way to get people housed. You don't have to build a whole new shelter. You can just buy the property, retrofit it, and then get folks in.
Of course, the city council has already approved going ahead with that. But are they looking at any other properties, retrofitting other motels to use as transitionary shelter?
They are, yes. They had a spot by the airport on East Riverside, but it was restricted because it was so close to the airport. Zoning-wise, you couldn't retrofit to have a residential property there.
KUT's Andrew Weber. You can read all of his reporting about this at KUT.org. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Yes, sir.
The city of Austin is looking for volunteers to serve on a commission that helps investigate concerns about police conduct. KUT's Donnie Matias reports.
The commission will review officer-involved shootings and make training recommendations, among other things. It isn't the first time the city has had something like this. The Citizens Review Panel was in place for 17 years. It ended after contract negotiations with the police union stalled in 2018. Farah Muscadin is the director of the Office of Police Oversight. She says this time, the commission will be more transparent.
Their recommendations and the responses, any sort of reports that they generate. This commission will also be holding community forums. So all of that, I think, helps in terms of the difference and helps in terms of the commission having more teeth because what they'll be doing will be much more public.
Muscadin says the commission will provide information online at atxpolicecommission.org. The deadline to apply to the commission is February 29th. Interviews will begin in March with final decisions in April. Dani Matias, KUT News.
Austin City Council members got a chance this week to ask staff about the latest draft of the revised land code. As KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports, the city's trying to make it possible to build more housing in the city, but where that housing should go, that's an ongoing conversation.
A conversation focused on so-called transition zones. These are the parts of neighborhoods alongside busy roads where council wants the new code to allow for more homes. The idea is to zone the city so you transition from a denser commercial road to small apartment buildings, then to triplexes, duplexes, and then single-family homes. Councilmember Kathy Tovo represents District 9. That's much of central Austin. The city's consultants predict these zones in Tovo's district would account for roughly 2% of the new housing. So Tovo asked, for so little, is that even worth the change?
So it's a lot of disruption, and I think is going to result in really significant redevelopment and very significant changes, potentially to the point where some of those areas are unrecognizable, potentially for very little gain.
A consultant for the city said he expects the most new housing to be built on busy streets, likely large apartment buildings. But Mayor Steve Adler said the advantage of these transition zones is the ability to build different types of housing. Right now, it's hard to build anything other than single-family homes or big apartment complexes. They're expected to take a final vote on the plan by the end of March or early April. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
It has been 2 months since the city of Austin began closing Rainy Street to vehicles on weekend nights. KUT Samuel King reports the pilot program has needed some adjustments.
The Austin Transportation Department is working with Austin Police on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights in the rainy area. And APD officers have discretion over when to begin or end the closure each evening based on conditions. On some nights, that means the street only closes for a few hours, if at all. Cole Kitten with the Austin Transportation Department says they're using observations during the pilot as well as people's experiences to determine what's next.
Those two factors would be put together to determine whether or not ultimately Rainy Street could be closed to vehicle traffic if Red River Street extension was in place.
Over the next month, the city will be using an online survey to get feedback on the idea of closing Rainy Street. The pilot program is expected to run through early March. Samuel King, KUT News.
It has been almost 10 years since the Labor Day weekend fires back in 2011. Wildfires around Austin destroyed thousands of homes, mostly in Bastrop County. But it was an eye-opener about the risks this region faces from wildfires. And now the fact that Austin's growing and expanding even more into wildfire-prone areas, concerns are growing that we're not prepared for the next big wildfire. So recently, some community leaders got a visit from people who have a lot of experience dealing with destructive wildfires near urban areas. Firefighters from California. The Texas Standard's Jill Amond has that.
I don't think there's anybody here who would argue that this is not a fantastic view.
On a sunny and windy day last week, about 40 people crowd the top of a scenic hill country overlook in Austin. But they're not here for the view. This group of city and state leaders are listening as firefighters from California and Austin point out the cedar trees and brushland climbing up the incline. They also note the strong winds funneling up the overlook. Despite the spot's great views, it's a fire hazard. A potential wildfire could quickly travel up this slope through the trees and brush, threatening dozens of homes nearby.
I look at the continuous fuel that goes right up to the houses, and I'm like, ah, you know, that is, in the conditions that we've experienced, that is not good.
That's Dave Russell. He helped coordinate the firefighting response to California's most recent mega fires, including the Camp Fire in 2018. That's the one that destroyed the town of Paradise, California, and killed 85 people. After going over the risks at the overlook, everyone climbs onto a charter bus. From there, the group travels to other densely populated neighborhoods near Lake Austin and Lake Travis.
The first thing that stuck out to me, and I'm from California, was there's already traffic.
That's retired California firefighter Todd Durham.
So if you cannot get people out of harm's way in a timely fashion on the roadways, what are you going to do to protect them?
Durham and Russell spent 2 days here touring some of Austin's most wildfire-prone areas. More than 60% of the city's homes and businesses are located in wildlands, making that fire risk one of the highest in the nation. The tour was put on by the Austin Firefighters Association. Bob Nix is the association president. He worries Austin's rapid growth in the city's risk areas, combined with climate change, will create a similar wildfire outbreak that happened around the Austin area nearly 10 years ago.
When we have sustained winds coming out of the north or west at 30 miles an hour for a couple days, which is kind of what we had during the 2011 fires, it's going to be bad.
The California firefighters say Austin should keep investing in wildfire response training for its firefighters. They also advise homeowners here to fireproof their homes by doing things like keeping dry leaves out of gutters or reducing flammable brush in yards. In Colorado and California, officials have approved housing codes requiring residents there to fireproof their homes. In those states, builders must use flame-resistant construction materials. They also have to build homes a certain distance from each other. Bob Nix with the Austin Firefighters Association wants Austin to do the same.
There's ways we can reduce our risk, but we all have to know it's important. We all need to work together. We need to get on it.
Austin City Council member Jimmy Flanagan's district is largely in a high wildfire risk area.
It's not a question of, do we now believe there is risk? And it's not even a question of, do we now think we should do something? It is, what is the best thing to do?
He also wants the city to approve some wildfire codes.
We got to figure out what we can require and what we can enforce. And state law and the state legislature doesn't always let cities do all the requirements and enforcement we wish. And so that, to me, is the thing I want to make sure we get right.
If Austin does adopt a set of wildfire codes, the city would be the first in Texas to do so. Reporting for KUT, I'm Jill Ament.
This week, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality held a public hearing on a proposal to build a garbage transfer station in North Austin. As KUT's Mose Bouchel reports, neighbors and public officials and environmental groups are opposing the project.
The Austin Community Landfill off Highway 290 is filling up fast. So Waste Management, the company that owns it, says it needs to build a station there to bring in garbage from local customers and haul it out to other landfills. But people in nearby neighborhoods and elected officials say that will worsen problems they're already having with the landfill. Jeff Jacoby is with the group Texas Campaign for the Environment, which also opposes the project.
We could be dealing with odors. We'll be dealing with over 1,100 truck trips per day, dealing with vermin. And so this proposal could continue, as the landfill has been, to be a blight on the surrounding communities.
To build the trash transfer station, Waste Management needs to get permits from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. Mose Bouchel, KUT News.
The Texas Democratic Party has launched a program that the party says will protect voting rights in this year's elections. As KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, the party has announced it's partnering with a national voter protection group called Fair Fight.
State party officials say they received a historic donation from the group. And this money allows the party to assemble a team of people working to prevent possible issues during voter registration and at the polls. Rose Clauston, who works on voter protection for the Texas Democratic Party, says this will also allow them to launch a voter assistance hotline earlier than usual.
Normally, voter protection doesn't start until the fall. But because of Fair Fight's investment and support, we're able to get started right at the beginning of the year. And we are going to be tackling these issues in the primary and in the primary runoffs all the way through the summer and into the general election.
The party also plans to put together a voter protection council, which will include hundreds of Democratic volunteers tasked with monitoring voting issues across the state. The party also plans to start a poll watching program for the upcoming presidential primary. The first day of early voting is February 18th. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Austin Resource Recovery is increasing its capacity for recycling foam polystyrene, commonly known as styrofoam. KUT's Sangeeta Menon has that.
Austin Resource Recovery is using a $45,000 grant from the Foam Recycling Coalition, which supports increased recycling of food service packaging. It's installing a second foam recycling unit at its Recycle and Reuse drop-off center. That location takes drop-offs from Austin residents and, for a fee, from businesses. Austin Resource Recovery's Andy Dawson says the one machine they have now has to be running nonstop to keep up with demand.
It has grown by leaps and bounds in the last couple of years. We now take in 1 month what we used to take in a whole year. So trying to keep up with that demand of such a popular program has been challenging without this addition.
Dawson says the additional machine will be operational by early summer at its drop-off location, but won't enable residents to be able to recycle the foam curbside. Sangeeta Menon, KUT News.
Some changes are on the way for Austin ISD schools on the competition front. KUT's Jimmy Moss reports on the University Interscholastic League's district realignments for football, basketball, and volleyball released this week.
A couple of big changes on the horizon are the result of the split of LBJ High School and the Liberal Arts and Science Academy for UIL competition. After the split, LBJ will be one of the lowest enrolled schools in AISD. It will drop to 4A competition and play football in a district with Taylor, along with Hill Country schools, including Fredericksburg and Canyon Lake. For basketball, LBJ will go east to face the likes of Giddings and LaGrange. Meanwhile, LASA will compete in basketball in a 5A district made up mostly of AISD competition. LASA will not field a UIL football team. Anderson High moves from 6A down to 5A, along with Pflugerville-Hendrickson. Other changes for area schools: Hutto moves up to 6A, Liberty Hill and Buda's Johnson High move up to 5A. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
The official sport of Texas is not football. It's rodeo. The Texas legislature voted to make it rodeo a while back, and Rodeo Austin is a little more than a month away. It runs March 14th through the 28th. Great option for people who want to do something family-friendly far away from the crowds of South by Southwest, which also happens in mid-March. You see cowboys, you see cowgirls competing in barrel racing, bucking broncos, calf roping. Might be fun to watch, but this takes a toll on the bodies of rodeo athletes. So check out this piece from Christopher Connolly from the new Dickies Arena in Fort Worth. Their rodeo wraps up Saturday night. He looks at a sports medicine team that keeps competitors healthy.
Folks, this ain't your granddaddy rodeo. You're in Fort Worth, Texas.
Tim O'Connell has won 3 world championships in bareback bronc riding. In a black cowboy hat and red, gold, and white chaps, O'Connell settles onto the back of a horse, and the gates burst open. The horse bucks and jumps, all 4 hooves lifting off the ground. O'Connell slaps back against the horse again and again, keeping one hand in the air the whole time. It's over in just 8 seconds. O'Connell ends this round with a top score and no injuries, but this is a sport where that's hardly guaranteed. Last year, a major shoulder injury took him out of competition for nearly 9 months. That tops his list of injuries so far.
I tore my collarbone off my sternum, separation of the SC joint, broke my riding hand. I had a spiral fracture in my riding hand. It didn't require surgery or anything like that, but you know, obviously, like the little things, like, you know, I've broken all my knuckles.
It's not a matter of if you get injured, but when, says bull rider Sage Kimsey.
Just in the last few years, I've got a totally torn UCL in my elbow, fractured my pelvis, broke some ribs, broken both arms before, broken feet. It's a tough sport for sure.
And you're how old?
I'm only 25. Yeah.
Kimsey and every other rodeo athlete are basically independent contractors. Some have sponsors, but this is a sport where, by and large, you don't get paid if you're not competing and winning. So, unlike professional basketball or football players, rodeo athletes don't have dedicated team doctors to keep them healthy. That's where the Justin Sports Medicine Team comes in. Dr. Tandy Freeman is the medical director.
We can put them in a boot. We can put them on crutches. We can give them a prescription for their pain medicine, but they don't end up with a $1,000 bill.
At more than 125 professional rodeos across the U.S., the Justin Boot Company staffs clinics with hundreds of on-site doctors, physical therapists, and athletic trainers, almost all of them volunteers, who take care of athletes free of charge. The Justin Clinics treat more than 8,000 people a year, giving away 250 miles worth of athletic tape and more than $1.5 million worth of medical care. Care that Freeman says a lot of rodeo athletes wouldn't be able to afford otherwise.
You know, there's several thousand members of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. The reality of it is there are probably about 300 that actually make a living rodeo.
The program launched in 1981 with the idea of bringing professional sports medicine to professional rodeo. Dr. Jason Magoni, who volunteers with the team, says it's a world of difference from when he grew up watching both of his parents compete.
This didn't exist when they were rodeoing. I mean, my dad had torn up his knee and he wore a brace, and you know, my mom had a bad back, and you know, they just kind of dealt with it. Rub some dirt on it and hope for the best is about how it went back then.
Magoni says he sees all kinds of issues, from bumps and bruises and strains and sprains to the kind of damage that a fully grown bull can do to a human body.
You know, those things happen. Big cuts happen. Blood and guts happen. The bigger things to me are the people who come in with fractures that were at a rodeo that didn't have medical coverage, and they're like, what's wrong with my arm? Well, it's broken. Or what's wrong with my foot? Oh, yeah, that's definitely broken. That's going to need surgery.
For bull rider Sage Kimsey, though, the most important service they provide is helping athletes like him understand how to prevent injuries and manage recovery.
We're all a bunch of, ranch-raised kids for the most part. It's not like we have a whole lot of extensive knowledge, you know, about athletic training and what it takes to stay healthy and what it takes to stay at the top of our game. The knowledge, number one, is probably the biggest thing for me.
It's knowledge that'll help him next time he gets injured so he can get back in the arena and back on the bull. I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
That's KUT Weekend for the second weekend of February 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. Thank you.